Hello and welcome to Truth Without Radio. Today's date is Friday the 23rd of April 2021 and you're listening to me, Sven Longshank, streaming live tonight at RadioAlbion.com because we have with us the producer of Adolf Hitler, The Greatest Story Never Told, Communism by the Back Door and the Freemasonic Victors of World War II, Mr. Dennis Wise. Dennis, good day sir and a happy St. George's Day to you. How are you doing?
Yes, likewise, same back to you. Yeah, I haven't had a particularly bad week. Kind of put my feet up for most of it, and you know the family's going away for the weekend, which leaves me looking after myself, which is always good.
So you've been having a nice rest then, and recuperating from all the surgery and all the hospital visits and all the rest of it. So you're starting to feel a bit better then, are you?
Well, yeah, and I spoke to a doctor in America. I'd like to thank the person who paid for the interview, and she was very positive and followed the health foods, and I think she has some Chinese medicine training. So after I finished that conversation, which was about an hour long, I was really, really feeling good.
Feeling energised, yeah. Traditional herbs and medicine, that it worked for hundreds of years, didn't it? And also, I think
you can
tell if the person who is talking about it, if they're really well and healthy and full of life, you know it works, don't you?
Yeah.
I think it's.
I was really impressed.
Yeah, I think it's very good that one of your listeners helped you out with that as well and donated for that. I mean, that must have made you feel very good as well.
Yeah, well, it was because at the time, like you know, the documentary wasn't. We couldn't sell it, and so money was getting tight, and so she kindly offered, and I weren't really too keen on that really because it was expensive. But she said, just put it down to I've just. Paid towards some funds towards the documentaries, which was really fantastic of her.
Very nice of her. And talking of the documentaries, if people want to purchase copies of Adolf Hitler, The Greatest Story Never Told or Communism by the Back Door, they should go to MoneyTree.com/shop. And if you put that into your search engine, you should open up the page and the first two DVDs that you will see on there are Dennis's DVDs, which you can now purchase. I think it's four DVDs to each box, isn't it, Dennis?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure, yeah.
And that's both documentaries there that you can purchase, and a percentage of that money goes to Dennis. So if you want to donate and help Dennis's work here and the projects that he's involved in, then that's the way to do it. Buy yourself a DVD. And I think they work in all DVD players, don't they, Dennis?
Yeah, worldwide, yeah, whatever area.
Excellent stuff. Well, we've had some very good feedback on the Jewish emigration in the Third Reich, and apparently there's more to this story that we weren't actually able to tell in the episodes that we've done so far. So we may well revisit that next week and maybe the week after and try and keep that going. But this week I thought maybe we could talk a little bit about St. George, since it's St. George's Day today. In England, do you know much about St. George, Dennis?
To be honest, I don't. I think he slayed a dragon, or a legend says he slayed a dragon, but I could be wrong.
Well, that's what most people think about St. George. That they know that about him, but there's a lot more than that. And I've pulled together some notes about him, and I've talked about him before in other podcasts, but that was a couple of years ago. St. George is actually the patron saint of several countries, not just England, including Catalonia, Georgia, Lithuania, Palestine, Portugal, and Germany. And they're all white countries, basically, because you get this accusation that St. George is Turkish, and he wasn't Turkish. He was white. We'll get into the details of that. He's also the patron saint of scouting, and that's because St. George was responsible, truthful, devoted to duty, brave, noble, and dedicated to helping others, all things which should be desirable in a scout. And I think they're all things that should be desirable in a nationalist as well. Nationalists are really just grown-up scouts, I think. Would you agree with that, Dennis?
Well, as long as you don't pull my statue over if I ever have one.
I think scouting's a good thing for kids to get involved in, and then when you're an adult, you know, you should always strive to be the best person mm-hmm. that you can be, and be brave, be noble, be dedicated to helping others. That's what nationalism is about, is about helping others, helping out your nation, putting your nation's needs before your own. And the Legion of St. George, or St. George rather, was also taken as the name of the British Free Corps, which was the Waffen-SS unit for the British. The recruiting for the Free Corps was actually done in the German prisoner of war camps. And in 1944, leaflets were distributed to the prisoners of war. And the unit was also mentioned in Camp, the official POW newspaper published in Berlin. And the unit was promoted as a thoroughly volunteer unit conceived and created by British subjects from all parts of the empire who have taken up arms and pledged their lives in the common European struggle against Soviet Russia. And I find this interesting because obviously the Germans used St. George to appeal to the British prisoners of war to join the Waffen-SS. And in Britain, the British authorities were also using St. George to get the troops to sign up in Britain too. So we have one character there that appealed to both the British and the Germans. A sign of unity there to fight against the enemy, I guess. But you know a bit about the Free Corps. We've done a podcast on that some time back, didn't we,
Dennis? Yeah, John Emery. Son of Leo Emery, who was the cabinet minister, Churchill's cabinet. He was decided that he didn't want to fight for the Jews and Stalin, and instead left Britain to fight in Germany. He also fought in Spain and Italy, and was eventually hung at the end of the war. But he was predominantly the main man to get the SS, the British SS, off the ground.
So he was really the leader of the Legion of St. George, and mm-hmm. the others that were actually in the unit, I don't think they actually saw any fighting time. They got the training, and then they were ready to go on the Eastern Front. And don't forget, they weren't going to fight against the British. They were just purely for fighting against the Bolsheviks. It was to save Europe from the Bolshevik hordes. And
they did see fighting. It was when the Soviets were invading Germany. And the actual Russian general was glowing in his praise for him as they held him up and destroyed several tanks in doing so.
So they did see battle, but in Berlin.
They did see action, yeah, but in Berlin.
Right. I didn't gather that from the notes that I was looking at. And I think John Amery got hanged for it, and two of the others that they caught, they said, oh, we just joined them because we wanted to find out what the Germans were doing and we were going to sow a revolution. And I mean, what sort of a revolution were they going to sow amongst the Germans? With the bankers' way of doing things? Usury?
Move back? Yeah, well, I suppose they were under pressure, weren't they? Because obviously the traitors in their own country after the war. But really, like most people, you know, didn't really understand what that war were about. They did, once they were captured, and followed the heart. But it must have been difficult for them, because they would have been persecuted and imprisoned. And like John Amery was actually hung.
Well, obviously, you wouldn't want to fight against your own country. I mean, that would mean that you were a traitor. But if you were in a prisoner of war camp, and you knew that the Soviets were invading places like Finland, Lithuania, Latvia, Estonia, and you were offered the chance to go and defend Europe against these Bolsheviks, then it becomes a different matter. And the Latvians in particular, and the Lithuanians that did join up the Waffen-SS and defend their countries against the Soviets, they were absolved of any crimes at Nuremberg. In actual fact, the Latvian Waffen-SS unit were the guards at Nuremberg in the helmets. Yeah. So they were absolved of crimes, but...
But the problem is that the Soviet Union were our allies, and wearing a German uniform fighting against our allies, to a lot of people, class them as traitors. Not that I totally agree with that.
Yeah, that would have been the point, wouldn't it? No matter, really, they shouldn't have helped out. But there you go. John Amery paid for it with his life.
Yeah, and to be fair, it was Pierpont who hung him and said he was the bravest man he ever hung. So, and he hung a number of people, especially Germans, as you knew from a documentary.
Well, that's quite some praise to hear. Well, I also had a look at British Heritage, the anti-white British Heritage, and they have a page and they say 9 things you didn't know about St. George. Number one, and they make a big point of this, this is number one, he wasn't English. Well, okay, well, he wasn't English, but he was white. And the fact that all these other white countries have him as a patron saint shows that there was a sense of brotherhood at that time amongst white people, even though we weren't classed as being white. We were classed as being Christian. We were known as the Christians before we were known as the white race. So there was a sense of unity. They're trying to imply that he's Turkish. This is one of these big lies they tell about St. George. They'll try and claim that he was Turkish. He wasn't Turkish. He was white. And number two, they say he wasn't a knight. Well, okay, he wasn't a knight in shining armour, but he did fight for the Romans in the Roman Empire. He was in the Praetorian Guard. So he was the equivalent of a knight. And number four, they say he never visited England. Well, he did visit England because we've got places that are named after him. And we'll get into that as we get into his life. Well, he was actually born in what is now known as Turkey. But back then it was Cappadocia. And Boris Johnson's actually Cappadocian. So you can see that even though Boris Johnson is from all different backgrounds, you can see he's still got the blonde hair and the blue eyes. And that comes from Cappadocia.
He was short of a brain.
Yeah. Well, St. George was born in Cappadocia to noble white parents. I mean, that's what noble meant at that time. So he had white parents, and you shouldn't be confused with George of Cappadocia. He is St. George of Cappadocia. George of Cappadocia was an Arian bishop. He was a heretic, whereas St. George of Cappadocia is something completely different. And St. George's father served with distinction in the Roman army. He was a great warrior, and when he died, his son was offered the chance to follow in his father's footsteps, and his mother died as well, fairly young, and he was brought up in Lod, which is a place in Palestine, Leda, I think it was called back then, and it's called Lod today. So he was Cappadocian, but he was brought up in Palestine, so he has a link with the Holy Land, basically, and he was taken on by the Roman army. And he, just like his father, he fought with distinction. And after fighting with the Imperial Guard in the Persian Wars, George set up the Nestorian Church in Persia, which is a very ancient Orthodox church. And he supposedly founded that in the country where he was fighting against the Persians. And after the war, he settled in Beirut, which is in Lebanon, and he gave his name to the bay there. And that's why it's called the Bay of St. George. And it was soon after that that he travelled to Britain. And he was coming to Britain to see his old soldier friend, Constantine, who he had fought with in the Persian Wars. And Constantine was the son of the Emperor Constantius Chlorus. And his mother, who Constantius Chlorus married, was the British Princess Helena, who was the daughter of old King Cole from the nursery rhyme. So we have this link there with this old Welsh king, Constantine, and that was who George was going to visit. And the Irish Sea that he travelled through to reach South Wales, because that's where Constantine was, he was in South Wales, that's named after him as well, and that's called St. George's Channel. So that's the bit between Wales and Ireland. So he travelled up through that channel, and he visited Constantine, and then he must have headed on further up north because his heraldry was also adopted by Lancaster, and it's part of the Lancaster heraldry is the red cross on the white flag. So this is how we know that he did actually come to England, and it was hundreds of years ago. Now, Emperor Diocletian, who was the emperor at the time, was persecuting Christians soon after this, and actually 10,000 Christians were slaughtered in Britain. And we've got a place that is named after the first of these marches, which is St. Albans. And this is quite well recorded, this history, that 10,000 Christians were massacred. And it was all started by this Diocletian, who basically made Christianity illegal. But obviously St. George was Christian, but Constantine was Christian as well, because Constantine's mother was Helena, the British princess, and Christianity had been in Britain since about 150 AD. So this is like 200 years later. And we had bishops in Britain. We had a really established church. And Constantine, St. George's best friend, he was brought up to be a Christian. And he was very upset at what was happening here with these Christians being slaughtered. And so was St. George. So St. George went back to Beirut, which is where he lived, and he gave all his possessions away. Don't forget, this is a nobleman. This is a man with lots of possessions. So he gave all his possessions away to the poor, and he went to seek mercy for the Christians from the emperor, thinking that his service record would help him because he was such a great warrior. But instead of being swayed by his by what he was saying, Galerius, actually, who was there was three of them. There was Galerius, Constantius Chlorus, and Diocletian, and they were like a triumvirate. They were all the emperors. And Galerius actually had him tortured in horribly cruel ways, but George refused to back down and disown his faith. And I'll just stop there. Do you want to add anything to that, Dennis?
Well, I always wonder where they get the strength from when these, talking about Christians, obviously, but when they're tortured, a simple, yes, I don't believe would cure all the ills. And yet, there's many, many that have suffered great pain and not relented, which is quite a feat. I often wonder, could I do it, you know what I mean? Because you think of some ways of torturing you, don't you?
Well, it's incredible, really, when you think about it, the tortures that they went through. And if they hadn't gone through that, then Christianity wouldn't have taken off in the way that it did. It was because these men refused to recant. They refused to worship Caesar as a god. They refused to turn their back on Christianity, that they were tortured to death. And people saw them being tortured to death with smiles on their faces and not in any pain. It was like a miraculous occurrence. That's what's written about, and that is what really made people think, well, Christianity has to be the truth, because there's no other way that these men could just take death on like that without appearing to be in any pain at all. And the tortures of St. George must have been horrific, because they describe some of them, and you can tell that they've been exaggerated, but they've only been exaggerated because they must have been very, very horrible at the time, and they wanted to enhance that horror. Well, Diocletian attempted to bribe George with the promise of money, land, and slaves, but he again refused to turn against his faith, and 7 years' worth of torture began. First, he was stretched out on the rack, and his skin was torn with butcher's hooks, and then he was tied to machines that pulled him apart, and then he was beaten again. Legend has it that his wounds were then rubbed with haircloth, and salt was poured into them to increase the pain. George was then placed in a box lined with nails, which pierced his body, and he was then impaled upon stakes. Still alive, he was plunged into boiling water and had his head crushed by a hammer. As if this treatment wasn't bad enough, after these tortures, God was said to have visited him in his cell and told him he would die three more deaths before entering the gates of heaven. So he managed to survive this. So whether you believe that the tortures were these extreme or not, he must have gone through incredible tortures. The emperor's magician Athanasius was called, and he was asked to poison George. And George drank two cups of the potion and then returned to his cell. And apparently that was lead in the poison. And on seeing this miracle, Athanasius himself converted to Christianity and was immediately executed himself. The following day, George was skewered on a wheel of swords, chopped into pieces, and thrown down a well, sealed with a boulder. According to the story, the Archangel Michael then appeared to resurrect him, converting the 1,100 soldiers guarding the well, who were all then executed. George was then tied to an iron bed, and molten lead was poured into his mouth and his eyes. Nails were driven into his skull, and he was hung upside down over a fire with a stone tied around his neck. But again, he survived. George was then sawed in half, boiled, and after 5 days resuscitated from his second death. The third death came after a red-hot iron helmet was placed on his head and his body was ripped apart and burned. Finally, after converting the emperor's wife, Alexandra, and denouncing the Roman gods once more, George was decapitated and he gained his entry to heaven. Now, all of those tortures must have been tortures that they did to people. And because this was this one man that the story was going to be told about, they obviously made all the tortures happen to him instead of going through a long list of people and saying, and this torture happened to him, and this torture happened to him. So all of those tortures must have been the sort of things that they were doing, which is absolutely horrific.
I was going to say, I thought Braveheart had it rough.
It is horrific what went on.
7 years.
Yeah. 7 years of torture. And I mean, they say that he was brought back to life again, but that's just a way to bring all these tortures into one story. So we learn about the sort of things that the Christians had to put up with, the horrific things that were done to them at the time. It was absolutely savage.
You think lions were bad enough, wouldn't you?
Yeah, well, this is biblical as well. You know, these are the sort of tortures that went on in the Old Testament with the Assyrians and the Babylonians. I mean, we were a pretty savage people before we became Christian. I mean, that's all you can really say about it. And the refusing to worship Caesar as a god, the British always refused to worship Caesar as a god. The Druids wouldn't either. That's why the Christians first came to Britain. The apostles came to Britain. Britain was the first place to actually announce itself as Christian, is because we had this link. The Druids actually had a link with the Christians that were out there in Palestine. So George was decapitated, and his body was then returned to Lella in Palestine, and Christians soon began to revere him as a saint. Shortly after this, Diocletian abdicated, and Constantius Chlorus died. That's Constantine's father. Once Constantius Chlorus had died, Constantine, who was a British prince, was crowned king in Britain, and he left for Rome with an army of British nobles, and he was basically made emperor in Rome. And straight away, he made Christianity the religion of the empire, and he made his old friend St. George the example for all young men of Christendom to emulate, which is to fight with distinction, to show charity to the poor, and to be prepared to die for the truth. And he also built a church above St. George's remains in Lledda and dedicated various other churches to him. And that church was still there until the Muslims destroyed it in the 10th century. And then the Crusaders went there and they rebuilt it. And I think that there are ruins of it that are still there now. And they also built lots of St. George's churches in Britain. St. George's Chapel of Windsor Castle, where they had the funeral last weekend, that is said to have once held two fingers, part of the heart and part of the skull of St. George. And the official story is that Constantine saw a vision of a cross, and he was told, with this sign you will conquer, and he went and conquered Rome. But that doesn't really make a lot of sense. What does make sense is that Constantine was brought up a Christian because he was a British king, he was a British prince, and Britain was Christian. And that's why he made Christianity legal once he became emperor, and that also provides the link with St. George and why St. George was then known to Christendom. He was the example that everybody had to look to. And this was this was in the 4th century. So the traditional story tells us that we didn't actually have St. George as our patron saint until the 12th century. But the tradition of having him as a very, very important saint and an example for us to look up to goes right back to the 4th century. Do you want to comment on that?
I can't believe I haven't heard all this before.
Well, I think because of this link with Constantine and Constantine the King actually also being Constantine the Great and him actually being British, I think that's why it doesn't get talked about, because it all links in with Britain being the first nation to become Christian in 170 AD, which was before Rome became Christian. There was a Christian church at Rome, but the whole of Rome wasn't Christian. The British nation, the whole of Britain became Christian. I think it was 170 AD, and we had laws, and the only way that you could change the religion of the island was by unanimous vote. So everybody voted to change. That's the Druids that voted to change to Christianity. There was no having a fight over it or a battle over it or a war over it or anything like that.
I'm surprised early on at the opening, like I said, I didn't know a lot about him. I thought he killed the dragon, which is probably the amount what most people know about him. They've all heard of him. But I can't believe that all this isn't, or wasn't, maybe not today, you know, that's another story, but certainly when I was a kid, I thought this would have been taught in school.
Well, it's fascinating stuff. I think it was taught at school probably a century ago, but they don't want people to be patriotic now, and they don't want the British to think that they had anything to do with Europe. They want us to think that the British were savages and didn't know how to put one brick on top of the other until the Romans came here. And also, they don't want to alienate the other peoples that are here who don't really have such an illustrious history as us. And if they start talking about the great things that the British people did, they will say, oh, well, that's white supremacy, because you have to tell us about the great things we did. And then they say, well, we can only really tell you about things in the last couple of hundred years. So,
if that.
Yeah, this has been a complaint. This school in London at the moment that took down the flag and spray painted that the headmaster was racist and all this sort of stuff. Their complaint is that the headmaster wanted to study ancient kings and queens in history, whereas they want to study important black people from history. But there are only any important black people from the last 100, 200 years. There aren't any from 1,000 years back.
Unless you watch a Hollywood movie.
Yeah, or unless you make them up, which is
exactly is what they do.
Sadly, what they're doing now, because yeah. So, you know, other people might say, "Well, oh yeah, well, why do we have St. George as a saint? Isn't he Turkish?" Well, no, he's not Turkish. He was from Cappadocia, and he was white. And the fact we have him as a saint shows that Britain was connected up with Rome and Christendom and the rest of the ancient world, basically. Mm. But we'll get into the dragon in a bit as well, because there's more to the story yet. That was basically his life and how he was important way back in the fourth century. And he is talked about in the fourth century. He's mentioned as one of the earliest saints, one of the most illustrious saints. And obviously that was the church itself was built by Constantine the Great in Palestine. Well, legend has it that during the first crusade to Jerusalem in 1098, St. George appeared as a vision to lead the Christian knights during a siege, and Richard I adopted the cry, "For St. George," as they rode into battle. And I think the cry actually ended up becoming "For England and St. George." And he also adopted the red and white cross, now known as the St. George Cross, which symbolised blood on a battlefield. And on his return from the Crusades, conquering hero Richard I formed the Order of St. George. And those knights who had scaled the walls of Jerusalem were given the title Companions of St. George. And about 100 years later, King Richard III fashioned the entire uniform of a knight on the cross of St. George. So there's obviously some link with when they went over to Jerusalem, when the Crusaders went there. So they claim that they saw a vision. I think they may have seen this vision quite a few times. And that may tie in with St. Michael, because I think St. Michael appeared as a vision in the Old Testament. So whereas the Crusaders had St. George that would appear at these battles. And there's a link between St. George and St. Michael, because they both go after the dragon, but St. Michael has angel's wings. So that's how you can tell the difference. St. George is on a horse.
I wish he'd come back today.
Yeah. Well, they may do.
Work for him. Yeah, they may do.
And then we get to the dragon. The legend of George and the dragon came to the UK in the 12th century. And again, that comes from the Crusades in the Middle East. In the Eastern Orthodox Church, images of St. George slaying the mythical beast adorned the walls. And although the dragon was symbolic of Satan or evil, the crusading knights returned to England with tales of the saint's epic battle and became the basis of the St. George legend. So they're saying that the images on the walls were of St. George slaying Satan, basically, this devil, this dragon.
Yeah, but it became... that's the thought I had. Because usually they mention Satan with a dragon or a snake, reptile.
He does have a link with the dragon. And also, I think they were imagining it as the Turkmen or the Muslims or the Saracen. They became the devil, because they had we had these things called mummers' plays, and there was a St. George's mummers' play, and St. George would rescue the princess or the virgin who was being kidnapped by the Muslims, and he would rescue the woman from the Turks. I think, yeah, it was Turks at the time. And that was later on, I think, the 17th or the 18th century. So I think that was what it was symbolizing. St. George was symbolizing the Crusaders, and the dragon was symbolizing the Muslims that were attacking Jerusalem. And I think that was the origin of it. But also, there were quite a few different legends that talk about this. And according to the story, a dragon was terrorizing a village in Libya, where it devoured all the sheep and then turned on the inhabitants, who drew lots to sacrifice their daughters to the beast. St. George offered to rid them of the dragon if they converted to Christianity, which they did. And George then fulfilled his promise, slaying the dragon. And the relic of St. George's hand was venerated at a special church in Libya, which is supposedly where this dragon was slaughtered by St. George. But unfortunately, when Gaddafi was taken down and Libya was ransacked and destroyed by the anti-Gaddafi forces, they also destroyed the church, and the relic of the hand was lost. It had been there.
Because that was a communist revolution, if people don't realise.
Yeah, and you think Libya is 99% Muslim, but there was this small group of Christians that were at this church. I mean, it must be horrific what was done to them. So there's a link with St. George there as well. And interestingly enough, Muslims also pay him respects. And I do find that interesting because they say, well, there are things in common between Judaism, Christianity and Islam, but there's nothing to do with the Jews, with St. George. But the Muslims see him as a prophet. And it's a bit strange because they link him with the colour green, and they call him Al-Qidr. And they say that he knew the apostles, and he was able to resurrect a few times, resurrected people from the dead. And he also has something to do with vegetation and foliage, and he makes flowers grow out of columns. And so he has something to do with vegetation. So he has a link there with the green man, which is the image which we have in the churches in Britain, this green man, the face with all the foliage that comes out from it. And the actual word itself, George, is linked with geology, geography, and it means to come from the earth. So as well as the actual man himself, I think there were attributes to do with earth spirits or with vegetation gods, vegetation deities that also got transplanted onto the legend of St. George. And funnily enough, the Muslims are the ones that adhere to that, which I find very strange because they're usually very against things like that. But apparently, yeah, they honour St. George as a prophet. And
it's a weird one because they mentioned Jesus in the Quran.
Yeah, they do, but they call him a prophet, don't they?
Yes,
and they have some characters from the Old Testament, but to have St. George, and they still, you know, they say he's the good guy, St. George. It's surprising, and that he has all these, as I say, sort of
admirers.
Yeah, and these miraculous attributes that he has. Mm. But yeah, that's our link with St. George, and that's the potted history of him. And there are a couple of good books. There's George of Leda, which is written by Isabel Hill Elder. And there is St. George by E.O. Gordon, which is another good book. Both of those books are good patriotic books to read about St. George. I don't know if you want to add anything else, Dennis, about St. George.
Well, I'm just flabbergasted that I didn't realise... apart from killing this dragon, I didn't know really much about him. I can envision him as a crusader. But say he's a patron saint of England, and, you know, being brought up in England in an English school, and a Christian school, I'm disappointed I wasn't taught more than what I was.
Well, and also it's the traits that that he exemplified. You know, he was a very rich man, but he gave his riches to the poor. He was a great fighter, a really great fighter, fought with distinction, or a warrior for the Romans. And then he stood up for the poor and the oppressed. And he was willing to die for the truth. He was willing to take on all these tortures rather than renounce the truth. So he stood up for the truth. So it's all those attributes that
impressive, yeah.
Yeah, and they sort of exemplify what it used to mean to be English, to be British. You know, that was the sort of man that you wanted to be. And before that, that was what all of Christendom wanted to be. And that's why he was put forward as this this champion knight of Christendom. We also had another auspicious day this week. On the 20th, we had Adolf Hitler's birthday. And I'm not quite sure how old he would have been. Do you know, Dennis?
No, off the top of my head, no. But I do know, I watched a channel on YouTube about him and his World War One escapades, and it was really quite a fairly decent account of him. And reading through the comments underneath, there were people who said, this guy isn't the same guy, again, what I was taught in school. You know, because obviously with the documentary, I knew he'd won 6 or 7 medals and won a, you know, first class Iron Cross, et cetera. And a lot of people in the comments were shocked at the way this guy apparently came out of this forest. He was one of the officers who recommended Hitler to get this Iron Cross. And Hitler and another guy who was a runner as well in the trenches. And a lot of people often say, you know, it wasn't the dangerous job that people say, which it actually was. And this was confirmed again in this mini documentary. But Hitler and this guy, as this guy came out of the woods to survey, you know, the battlefield, they both stood in front of him to take any bullets. You don't hear a lot of things like that about Hitler.
Well, it must have been a dangerous job that he did, because he was delivering the mail to the front lines. I mean, he literally had to climb up out of the trench and run to the next trench in front of him to drop the mail off.
I think there were 10 of them, apparently. 4 were killed. 1 was seriously injured. And Hitler was one of the remaining 5.
And he volunteered for that as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
And he got gassed, he got hit by gas and said that gas, that was absolutely barbaric and they would never use gas, never ever use gas in war. And that was a promise he made. I remember reading that years and years ago and thinking, well, how does that square with this story that we've been told that all these Jews were gassed in Germany? If Hitler said that they were never going to use gas. And I can remember at the time thinking, well, what's going on here? Because this—that is officially known, isn't it? That he said that.
The truth never sits right when it's been tampered with. There's a famous photograph actually of a line of British soldiers, because the wing changed, and not only did the Germans and Hitler get blinded, but a lot of British got blinded as well when the wing changed. And there's a famous photograph of maybe, I don't know, 10, 20, all with the hands on the soldier in front. And all blinded.
He must have had compassion. I mean, for somebody to be blinded like that and to think, you know, he may never see again and have to be looked after people because he can't see, because he's blind, and then to come back to life again. I mean, that is somebody that is going to be a compassionate person afterwards, isn't it?
Yeah, well, that was a problem that they didn't realise. He probably did think he was blinded for life, you know, because there was the first time this has ever been used. And obviously, you know, if he's in hospital for several months and blinded, you know, the doctor can only say to him, don't worry.
And he was, I mean, very, very brave and fighting for his country like that and understanding compassion. And he also knew what life was like to be very poor. I mean, he was homeless for a while, wasn't he?
Do you know, I was just going to say that. He's the only politician I know that's known starvation.
Living on the streets, spending time homeless, and going from that to leading a first world nation and being at the top of politics. I mean, wherever you stand on Hitler, whether you think he was a good person or you think he was a bad person, you have to admit that it's an incredible story to have risen up from being a homeless person to being the Führer of Germany.
Greatest story ever told.
And obviously there was also his artwork and that played into things.
Well, that's another thing they touched on, because they said, no matter what you say about Hitler, this person was commenting, said, them paintings look good to me. Can't believe he didn't get into the university. The reason that he didn't get into the university was they were looking for more technical artists. He was a more natural artist. He painted Jesus and Mary and, you know, figures. And although he wasn't bad at painting buildings, but it failed on that account rather than his natural ability. He's pretty much like myself, you know, because I went to art college and I took my GCSEs, and the guy who was taking the art class said, what are you doing here? And I said, well, I'm going to take three out of these five. And he suggested three completely different subjects than what I took. And he laughed when, when I said I was taking them. That was a nude model, a plant, and someone else. And I got my A-level and smiled at him.
Good man, good man. I think he understood aesthetics, didn't he? Because he was helping out with the designs when they were going to rebuild Norway, weren't they?
Architecture, yeah, yeah. We're going to rebuild Europe, yeah.
So he did learn about architecture and technical drawing as well. I've got I found a couple of quotes actually as well. I was looking through the speech, the National Socialist Seventh Congress, which was actually the third Congress since they'd actually been in power, and Hitler was speaking about Christianity. And I thought maybe we could just have a look at these quotes that I have here from him. He said, "The party never
feuds about this." Yeah, go on, carry on. Sorry.
He said, "The party never had the intention, and it has not the intention now, of engaging in any kind of hostilities against Christianity in Germany. Our aim has been in quite the opposite direction. We have sought to unite the various regional Protestant churches whose conditions of existence were impossible and create one great evangelical church throughout the Reich without interfering in the slightest with questions of religious belief or practice." And we told this story, Dennis, didn't we? We did a whole series on what they were doing there, where they were trying to build up a nationalist German church like the Church of England. And I think three or four parts, maybe five parts, Protestant Christianity, National Socialist Protestant Christianity, that's what the name of the series is. And he also said, "By concluding a concordat with the Catholic Church, the party has sought to establish a state of affairs which would be beneficial to both sides and which would be of a permanent character. The party has abolished the organisations that belonged to the atheist movement, and whilst doing this, it has cleared our whole life of innumerable symptoms, the suppression of which is or ought to be the task of the Christian denominations." So again, he's saying there that the goal of the Christian churches to get rid of atheism is the same as the goal as the nationalist socialist state, who has succeeded in getting rid of all these atheist organisations. I would link Darwinism with that atheism, wouldn't you?
Yeah, without a doubt. This science made religion. Darwinism was certainly part of that. But the problem they had with the Catholic Church was during the Weimar government, which wasn't a Christian government, there were many infiltrators of the Catholic Church, many left-wing priests. And when the National Socialists first attempted to come to power, these people wouldn't even give them a decent burial. It was only after Hitler won the election and then the right wing of the Catholic Church, who signed the Concordat, they then disbanded their own centre party, which had been infiltrated.
I've just got a message in the chat room there that Adolf Hitler is 132 years old.
Happy birthday, sir.
And he continues with his speech here. He says, "But on no conditions whatsoever will the National Socialist State permit religious denominations to engage in political activities, whether these activities be a continuation of the old tradition or whether they be something started afresh. And here I should like to issue definite warning against the entertainment of any illusions whatsoever in regards to the fixed determination of the movement and the state. We have already fought the clerical politicians, and we have forced them to leave Parliament. It was a long struggle, and during the course of it, we held no public power whatsoever, whereas the others held all the power in their hands. But today we have this power, and it is easier for us to maintain the struggle on behalf of the principles I have mentioned. Yet we shall never turn this fight into a fight against Christianity or against any of the two great denominations. Yet we shall carry on the fight for the purpose of preserving our public life free from those priests who have forgotten their vocation and practiced politics rather than the care of the souls." That's what you were mentioning there, Dennis, about the Catholics that had become corrupted. He continues, "We shall also carry on the fight to unmask those who pretend that their church is threatened, while the unfortunate truth is that they themselves are only looking for the opportunity to be free of it." And that was the other problem that they faced, wasn't it? That they were saying that because the church was saying that Jews should be separate, there should be a German church for Christians, and if Jews wanted to be Christian, they should have a separate Jewish church. And they were saying that that threatened the whole church, and there were some Christians that were very, very pro-Jewish, basically, and they were saying that this was a threat to the church. So that's...
Yeah, well, don't say that. It wasn't exactly banning. Never banned any religion. But the problem was, after the war, they were tainted with this occult Third Reich. The Christian part of it has been hidden for obvious reasons. You know, since the fall of that particular Third Reich, then Christianity since has become almost obsolete. Certainly with the Pope, I can't even call him a Pope today, which leads us into oblivion. And it's just been one big cover-up. Because obviously there's still a lot of Christians around in the world, but even they're starting to feel the heat now. And that all started in World War II.
Well, that's one of the biggest secrets about World War II.
World War One, really.
How Christian the National Socialists were, and it may have been slightly different to the establishment mainstream Christianity today, but they were still Christian, and they stood for Christian principles in a way that hadn't been seen since, I don't know, Alfred the Great. I mean, he said it has to be deeds, not words, and he sought to have a revival. He was a great king. Go on.
Yeah, well, the problem were, I did it in the Secret Masonic Victory, that the Germans didn't believe that Jesus was a Jew. And without going into too much detail, I kind of explained why they thought that. And I do also believe he wasn't Jewish. And the thing what really gets me is, above him on the crucifix, written in Latin, you go on Google now and say, what does it say above Jesus on the crucifix, they'll tell you that it just says Jesus Christ, King of the Jews. Well, it doesn't actually mean that. And I'm pretty sure there must be people around today what can read Latin. It actually says Jesus, the leader of Judea, which is totally different from being King of the Jews, because Judea wasn't a Jewish area as such. They were only invited in.
Yeah, it was a multicultural area. It was like our multicultural countries today. So when they were talking about Judeans, it didn't mean just necessarily descended from Judah. It could mean anybody that was following the Judean faith, or anybody that was a Judean citizen. And Jesus actually put all his heritage down, all the family tree down, to make it certain people knew that he was of the tribe of Judah. He wasn't from any of these other peoples that had come into Judea. That was the point of putting it there. I mean, it basically says he was white. That's why he puts that family tree there. That's why people would have a family tree. And what they called it back then was noble birth. And Herod is recorded as being of ignoble birth, because he had Arab heritage, basically. He came from Edomites. We're getting a little bit off topic here.
Yeah, slightly off.
Getting back to Hitler's speech here, he says, "I need not assure you that we, National Socialists, have not sought this quarrel, for we know what the Bolshevik menace is, as it threatens the world today, and we are all too keenly aware of it. Not to wish that all forces could be united in combating it. Had communism succeeded, the problem of the 26 antiquated regional churches and that of the Catholic political centre would have been quickly solved. Wherever Bolshevism has come to hold power, the militant churches present a picture that is essentially far worse than that presented by the quote-unquote militant National Socialist movement in Germany, which with the sacrifice of innumerable marchers has beaten and routed the communist murderers and terrorists." So he draws a parallel there between what the communists have done to the church in Russia and what the Bolsheviks had done to the church.
Yeah, he kind of he got annoyed at Churchill and Roosevelt because they were claiming that he was persecuting Catholic priests. He was locking up these priests who quite rightly weren't preaching the gospel, but left-wing politics. And in mocking in mocking him, he kind of said, look, when Spain was at civil war, there was over 16,000 priests and bishops and everybody. Where were Roosevelt and Churchill then?
And there was a problem with paedophile priests back then as well, wasn't there, he was looking up?
There always will be when Freemasonry is involved, yeah.
They had a big problem with that and with the communists. And the traditionalist-minded priests were very pleased that the state had had stepped in and helped them to clean up the church. There was a big movement at the time of traditional Catholicism that was struggling against this progressive Catholicism. The progressive Catholicism became this liberation theology that Pope Francis preaches today. That's where that ended up. But back then, there was a struggle between these two forces within the church, and that's why the Pope, what was it? Pope Pius, was it at the time? And that's why he did this concordat, and that's why he worked with Mussolini and Franco as well, because it was clearing out the church from these communist-minded priests that were subversives.
Mm-hmm.
Still very, very subversive today. Well, I've got another quote here, but it's not actually from Hitler. This is from Gottfried Feder on religion and art from the program of the NSDAP. He says, "It is not possible to state on this subject more than a very few leading principles in the space of a program. That has already been done. For the rest, it must be our principle not to drag questions of religion into statements on general politics, although we may well treat the corrupting influence of the secret doctrines of Judaism as an object for public statements and attacks. The same applies to all the stupid attacks on Christianity. Expressions such as 'Christianity has only done harm' merely show that the man who says them has neither human nor political intelligence. One may well blame the church for meddling in politics, and all good Christians will disapprove the cruelties practiced in the name of the cross by the Inquisition and trials for witchcraft, but it is wrong to abuse in general terms the greatest phenomenon in human history for the mistakes and the depravities of individuals. The Christian religion has raised and edified millions and millions and brought them to God by the way of suffering. The culture of the Middle Ages stood up in the sign of the cross. Achievement, sacrifice, courageous faith all have their roots in Christianity. Thus, we must be careful to distinguish the inner spiritual kernel of Christianity from the various forms of excrescence which have appeared upon it in its passage through history. Our party stands upon the basis of positive Christianity. This is not the place to discuss all the problems, hopes, and desires as to whether the German nation may at some time discover some new form for its religious beliefs and experiences. These are matters quite beyond the limits of a program such as that of National Socialism." And note, when he says a new form, he's not talking about different religious beliefs or different experiences. He's just talking about the form that it would take, which is why they tried to join the two Protestant churches up together. And finally, he says, "We National Socialists wave our storm banner before the world. Ever young, shining and glittering in the sun rises the hooked cross, the symbol of reawakening life." So they saw what we call the swastika as a form of the cross.
And that's been twisted because people are told now that that's the occult. Many, many myths and lies about Nazi Germany.
Well, I mean, it's the Hakenkreuz, isn't it? It is a type of cross. It's a Christian symbol, and it was seen as a Christian symbol. They did not wish to be seen as anti-Christian in any way. To call them anti-Christian was a vicious smear, really, when you consider all
the call them communists, if they said anti-Christian.
Yeah, well, they couldn't call them communists, could they? So they thought, well, we'll just say that they're anti-Christian. And the truth was that it was the Bolsheviks. It was who Britain and America was allied with that were the real anti-Christians and that were torturing priests. And the priests that were put within camps were not put in camps because they were priests. They were put in camps because they were communists, terrorists.
Political agitators, yeah.
And subversives. That's the simple
thing. And Churchill, in his "We Will Fight on the Beaches" speech, mentioned that this was a war for Christianity, survival of Christianity. And people forget that the six nations that went into the Soviet Union, including Germany, were Christian. I'm sure Churchill knew that as well.
Well, the others that also helped the Germans, the Bosniak Muslims,
mm-hmm.
and they were fighting against the communists as well because they knew communism was atheism.
Yeah,
against all religions. They wanted to get rid of all religions, apart from, I guess, secular Judaism was okay. They allowed that. They encouraged that.
Yeah, put up with that, yeah.
But Christianity and Islam, they wanted to destroy. So that was the uniting factor, was people that were religious, people that believed in God. They could see the threat that was coming with the Bolsheviks, and they wanted to unite and fight against it. And the leaders of that fight against it were the National Socialists. It's such a shame today that people that get attracted to National Socialism then become anti-Christian because they're just following mm-hmm. the Hollywood version of what the National Socialists were. Not looking at the actual history of it. I mean, we've done so many podcasts on this, Dennis, haven't we, and series.
Mm.
And there's so much evidence out there. We've done two series, particularly on the church, fascism and Catholicism, and the Protestant series on the two churches. And if people want to look them they're on the just under the banner on the homepage.
Well, the Jews declared a holy war in 33 when the Islamics came into the war to help Germany. They declared a holy war on the Jews, and I'm pretty sure there were enough dead Christians around at the end of World War II to say that it was a holy war and they were defeated.
It looks like a holy war in some of the propaganda, doesn't it, where you can see them all marching forwards and then they've got this Asiatic Bolshevik and he's kicking down a cross.
That poster, that's lived the test of time, that one. That I mean, a picture tells a thousand words, if ever that is one.
And there are also lots of St. George or St. Michael and the Dragon imagery throughout. Mm. Particularly on the German side, but as I say, also on the British side, there's that famous British picture which I'm going to put with the podcast today, which was to encourage British people to sign up. But also, this imagery was used throughout Germany of St. George slaying the dragon, slaying the serpent, slaying the base urges, and being a good person and striving to be a good person, which is really what National Socialism was about. Was about trying to be the very best person that you can be. It was all about honor and loyalty and all those traits that we pointed out that St. George had, that St. George embodied, and that's what it meant to be a European. That's what it meant to be part of Christendom. You wanted to be noble, honorable, charitable, and you also wanted to be willing to lay down your life for your country, to defend the people that were weaker than you, the women and the children and the elderly, and doing what you can to improve your nation and to improve your people. And that's all we want as nationalists.
Like John Emmett to me, that.
It's all we want as nationalists. We just want to do what's right for our people, and we want to bring that message to everyone. You know, not just white people. Nationalism would benefit every nation in the world. To be doing what's best for that nation instead of trying to do what's best for individuals and greed gets in the way and all the rest of it. I've got another message here in the chat room from Captain R. He says, but before we had St. George, St. Edmund was our original patron saint.
And
I think that was in about the 10th century. Edward the Confessor. He died, and he was actually English, and he was martyred in some way, and made into a saint, and then he was superseded by St. George. So raise a toast to St. George, the defender.
Indeed, yes, impressed with him.
And also in memory of Adolf Hitler, who was 132 this week. Well, I think we'll leave it there, Dennis. Thank you very much for coming on today.
Pleasure. Okay.
Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. We will be back next Friday with more Truthful Out Radio for you. And, of course, we do hope you have a great weekend ahead of you.